Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Optusport Football Podcast. I'm joined by Phil Kitromilidis and former Denmark goalkeeper Thomas Sørensen. Guys, it's been a busy weekend of football news, which means that two of Europe's biggest clubs will be looking for a new manager in the summer. Phil, probably fair to say a Klopp was a little bit more surprising than the Xavi news, right?
We've been speaking on the podcast for the last few weeks about Xavi's future, and I've said a few times that I expected him to not be sacked before the summer, and then in the summer reassess his situation. So it wasn't a massive surprise that he announced that he's going at the end of the season, but at the same time, the way it was done did leave us a little bit aghast. So we'll get into it a little bit later on in the program. But yeah, I think it's fair to say that Klopp was a bigger shock, and absolutely no one saw that coming.
Thomas, what was your first reaction when you heard the news about Klopp?
Is it April Fool's? It was definitely a huge bombshell for me, you know, especially how it's been going this season. You know, had it happened end of last season, I could have potentially, you know, understood it. You know, he signed a new deal. He's got a contract until 2026, I think. And the way it's going, you know, he's energized the team. They're playing so well. He looks happy, smiling. So I think it's just, not just me. It took everyone by surprise.
Yeah, let's start with Klopp, who has dropped the bombshell that he'll be stepping down as Liverpool manager at the end of the season. To guide us through the discussion, we're joined by Oliver Kay, who covers Liverpool as a senior football writer at The Athletic. So, Oliver, welcome, first and foremost. Secondly, why has he left, and are you surprised?
Yeah, first of all, yes, definitely surprised, or definitely surprised on Friday. Maybe it makes a bit more sense with the benefit of hindsight, joining up some of the dots and maybe thinking the writing was on the wall slightly. I messaged a few people saying on Friday immediately saying, wow, didn't see that coming. And they said, well, yeah, I think had this happened 12 months ago, they would not have been surprised. Similar to what Thomas was saying, really, that he did look tired. He looked tetchy and looked sort of like he was struggling to see a way out this time last year. So had he left at the end of last season, I don't think that would have massively surprised people. But it's just the fact that he's looked so re-energised, so reinvigorated, so up for it with this new look team. And the symptoms that he talks about in terms of feeling tired, he hasn't shown those outwardly. He's looked like somebody who's you know, really, really buzzing again and really enjoying it. But I think basically he knows that however energized you might feel in when things are going well, I think he just dreads those periods where they fall away again or have a difficult period of a few weeks and he just feels things get on top of him and it becomes unbearable. So he's sort of wanting a way out now at the end of the season, because he knows the cycle and ebb and flow of how these things go.
Can I just ask, Oliver, from a journalistic perspective? We'll get into the footballing stuff in a second, but just from a journalist perspective, how rare is it that a story like this breaks and no one has any kind of idea that it's happening? Because in the era of social media and here we go and all that stuff, no one saw this coming.
Yeah, it's really rare. It is really, really rare, especially with a story this big and where, you know, clearly Klopp had shared it with his sort of most... He's very, very tight in a circle at Liverpool and the very senior management at Liverpool. He said he told them in November. I'm amazed it didn't come out. I mean, I know if I can mention, say, David Ornstein at our place and James Pearce,
yeah,
who have such incredible Liverpool contacts. I'm amazed it didn't come out. It's so rare, and it must. I think a lot of journalists have been left, you know, kicking ourselves, thinking, how did we miss this? But it's, to be honest, Liverpool has become a club where it's become, you know, very much, very little leaks out against the club's wishes. Sometimes the club are happy for stuff to leak out, but it's not the leaky club it was 20 years ago when they were a mess. Manchester United is not the type ship that it was 20 years ago where they were doing brilliantly. So it's, yeah, when you know when something is kept in house so successfully for 2 months that it's a pretty tight ship, put it that way.
Oliver, do you believe the reason? Do you think the reason's genuine, like as in burnt out, relax? Is he not going to take another job for a year? I mean, obviously, a couple of days later, the Barcelona job becomes available at the end of the season. So do you believe something like that could tempt him, or do you think he'll genuinely wait a year, like he says?
I think he will wait. I mean, I know when he left Dortmund in 2015, it was his intention to take a sabbatical then and return to work the following season. Then Liverpool job came up in the October, and he was like, yeah, I'll do that. And it was, look, that Liverpool job was a mess at the time. It's not, it wasn't an easy gig by any means. He's made it look that way at times, but that was, I think the fact that he was willing to take Liverpool in October 2015 tells you he was just desperate to get back to work. Whereas now, I really, really think, knowing what I know about him and people close to him, that he's serious about this and wants to take a proper year off.
And Oliver, throw this to you. Like, how do you think Liverpool go about, the Fenway Sports Group that's behind, how do you think they go about replacing him going forward? Because you're replacing a figurehead that's obviously, you know, whose energy and inspiration is running through the club, and you're also leaving a power vacuum. You know, you've had Michael Edwards, Julian Ward, and now Smatka is leaving at the end of this transfer window. You've got players, big players on 18 months contract, Mo Salah. You know, do you think they have a strategy now? Do you think they have foresighted this? Do you think they have a very defined short list of managers and a clear vision of how they're going to replace Klopp and how they're going to sustain this success going forward?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question, because had this happened 2 or 3 years ago, or I think you could see a really clear strategy at the club, or you could see what the long-term plan is, and Klopp was a big part of that, but it wasn't 100% him. I think the last couple of years we've seen two sporting directors leave and an interim about to leave. It's been clear to me, I think that sort of long-term plan strategy hasn't really been there in the same way. And I think they've become incredibly reliant on Klopp's decisions or decision-making, his powers of inspiration on the pitch and so on. But just for planning and just for strategy and just for... So I think I would have trusted more the Liverpool of 3 years ago when Michael Edwards was still there to have a plan B, to have a sort of, well, this is what we're going to do next. And now we're hearing, well, they've got the two very important positions to fill, sporting director and manager stroke head coach, and you know it might be a case of seeing which one they can fill first and then filling the other. You can't really have as much confidence in the decision-making process and the strategy as there was perhaps 2 or 3 years ago. But I mean, the idea of Xabi Alonso is the one that I think comes to everyone's mind, isn't it? I think that was everybody's first thought on Friday, mine included. So it would be interesting to see, you know, perhaps if it was the Liverpool of 2 years ago, 3 years ago, they would have been able to make a really, really persuasive sales pitch to somebody in Xabi Alonso's position. Will they be able to make that pitch now? Who makes that? I just don't know.
So interestingly, would for someone like Xabi Alonso, do you think because of his, I suppose, stature or reputation growing ever so quickly, even in a short period of time of becoming a manager, do you think Liverpool potentially might not be, I don't know, it's hard to say this, but like kind of the right move for him, maybe big enough move for him, right, as his next one?
It's really hard to say. I mean, as a player, he was one who was always sort of one step, two steps ahead of everyone else on the pitch, and always sort of never took the wrong decision, it seemed. Maybe he's like that as a manager. I would say the two issues really are, one, from his point of view, well, one is he their preferred choice? But from his point of view, is it just an impossible job following on from Klopp? Is it like, I mean, I know the success in terms of trophies and league titles isn't on the same scale, but in terms of the void, is it like succeeding Ferguson at Manchester United?
Yeah.
And two, is there a, because it's not as clear who, how Liverpool will go about this, and who will go about it, and what their sort of recruitment strategy would be. Would there be a danger that they might just go in there blundering and sort of think, right, well, we need a decision now, Xabi or Roberto De Zerbi or whoever else, and pressure and put pressure on in the wrong way and turn people off. And he, by putting somebody under pressure to make a decision when in Alonso's case, he's, you know, having the season, it's incredible season at Leverkusen, might he think, well, that's disrespectful. You can't push me for answer. If you want an answer now, it's no. That's just me speculating. But it's going to be difficult for them to go into it in a way that gets the job, gets the right person in a really sort of ruthless, calculated way without scaring them off and scaring off their club.
Yeah, but for me, like, obviously, Xabi Alonso knows Liverpool very well for the 5 years he played there. Obviously, very new in his management career. He's done really, really well so far at Bayer Leverkusen. A side where he took over were in threat of relegation. So he turned the club around in the season he was there, the first season he arrived. And then this season now, contenders, which, you know, I mean, they're leading. And nobody ever thought they'd have a chance to do what they're doing. They're playing incredibly good football. He's improved every single player there at that club. I don't think a manager like, or someone like Xabi Alonso, I would think he'd be thinking, look, Real Madrid's job is done for now. Ancelotti's re-signed. I don't see him taking a Barcelona job because of that relationship being at Real Madrid. Liverpool, for me, seems like it's a big step up from where he is. If he were to win the title at Leverkusen, it's one of those ones. Can he do any better with Leverkusen? Where can he take Leverkusen from this point onwards? Is it the right moment then to go to places like Liverpool? And if he turns it down now, will he have a chance in the future? I think it's one of those ones. I think it's a really difficult one for Xabi Alonso to turn down. The question is, you mentioned it there about the legacy, about what Klopp has accomplished at Liverpool. Seven major trophies, obviously winning their first ever Premier League trophy, obviously have won the first division trophy many times before. Where does he rate? Like, if you look at Pep Guardiola, for example, and I'm talking about the creme de la creme, the will go down, in my opinion, as an absolute legend of the Premier League, having won 14 major trophies in the 7-8 years that he's been there, five-time Premier League winner, and has won the elusive Champions League now with Man City. Where does Klopp rate? Does he rate in the same category as someone like Pep Guardiola or Sir Alex Ferguson?
In terms of, I mean, you probably end up looking at trophy counts, don't you? I would say Guardiola's trophy count is going to be unsurpassable ultimately, wherever it ends up in his career, and just the football his teams have produced. And I know people will say, oh, he always has great players, but he makes great players incredible players, and he makes very good players great players, and he makes good players very good players. He's incredible. Klopp is incredible. I don't imagine you could say, in terms of what is a realistic expectation for Klopp to achieve at Liverpool, and what is a realistic achievement for Guardiola at Manchester City when he arrived 2016, and you'd say, well, they've probably both in different ways hit the absolute upper limit of whatever was expected. I think they've both, while winning a lot, actually exceeded expectations. So I find it hard to compare, for example, Guardiola with Ferguson, because it almost feels like a different sport, even a decade on. In terms of the great Premier League managers, I think people will probably either put Ferguson or Guardiola at the top, depending on their view. And then there would be, I would say, next on the pantheon, in whichever order, would probably be Wenger, Mourinho, Klopp. Maybe that order in terms of Premier League greats. But I think in world football, Klopp will go down as somebody who absolutely surpassed expectations at every job he's had. Absolutely.
Yeah,
without question.
Yeah, I definitely think that he's on the Mount Rushmore of Premier League managers, yeah, for sure. but I think for Liverpool now, we can throw all these names in the hat, and you know, De Zerbi and Alonso, and but I think for Liverpool, especially when you're trying to fill that vacuum that Klopp is going to leave, is you got to get the synergy right, because we've seen it so many times. We've seen it at Man United. Now you're trying to pluck and play some manager in, but you haven't got the sporting director. I think you got to get a team in there that works or can work together, you know, who's had a strategy, who's on the same page, because otherwise you're never going to fill that. So I think there's so many things that they'll have to go into that decision. And you know, back to my question, I just question that, you know, the Americans behind the club is, you know, is that much on the ball, you know, if they can actually get that done, and they're just going to go out and pick the next big thing that's on paper looks good, but doesn't really sort the house out, doesn't clear the house and get the structure in place.
Yeah, I feel looking at, I mean, a lot of people have praised Liverpool as a club and the way it's been run and the strategy and the recruitment and so on the last few years. And I think a lot of that praise is correct. But I also think it's overdone, because I think it underplays the extent to which Klopp is the one who makes players look better, makes players feel integrated straight away. You never hear of people, you never hear of cliques really at Liverpool. You never hear of players feeling, you know, completely disillusioned. Almost every player who they've signed has either lived up to or surpassed expectations. Maybe you just say the odd one, like Naby Keita, who didn't quite work out with injuries and so on. But it's incredible that, you know, in terms of their first team signings, that they just, everyone who goes in just seems to either hit the ground running or have the time and space to be able to build up to speed more slowly, and then they're running speed within 6-12 months. It's amazing. And I do think people, and maybe even the management themselves, as in the ownership, maybe they underestimate what a sort of genius he is in terms of motivation, in terms of the feel of the place that he provides. And I'm sure he can be difficult to work under, and I'm sure he can be difficult to work over in terms of managing him from above. But I think he will be the most, he'll be hugely missed, because I do think he's the one who pulls it all together.
Oliver, we mentioned one of the big names, Xavi Alonso, who's been linked with a job, De Zerbi, Michel, Inzaghi, Emery, Thomas Frank, Nagelsmann. The big question we want to know from an Australian podcast perspective, Ange Postecoglou has also been one of the names that have been sort of talked about. Can you see that being a possibility?
No. Sorry, Oliver, I'm a Spurs fan.
I could see him being on the list, and I don't think he'd be top of the list. And if he was at the top of the list, I think Liverpool are above Spurs in the food chain, aren't they? Realistically, the same way. I don't see it. I could see him cropping up in conversations, and I could see the job appealing to him. But no, I don't think it's the most likely one.
I just wanted to reflect a little bit on what we were talking about in terms of his legacy. And you look at the trophy count, and it isn't, you know, it's not huge. It's one Premier League. I mean, he's won the same number of league titles as Xavi Hernandez did at Barcelona in 2.5 years. A Champions League, which is fantastic, and a couple of domestic cups. It's not a monster haul. Liverpool haven't dominated English football during his time, but contrast that with the fervour and passion that he stirred up within supporters, and the outpouring of grief, basically, that we've seen with some sections of Liverpool fans. It feels like the connection that he had with the club went a lot more with what he did on the pitch, which obviously transformed them. They were a mess where he took over, and he took them to winning the Champions League and a first Premier League title ever. So he did great work on the pitch, but it almost feels like his connection with the club and with the City is deeper and goes deeper than what he did on the football pitch. He seemed to understand where he was and understand the city that he's in as well. And for Australian listeners, you know, Liverpool is a pretty unique place with a really sort of unique identity and culture and sort of heritage and the way that they view themselves and the world. And I don't know, Klopp seemed to really get that. And that's what's made his time at Liverpool all the more successful, not just the trophies.
Yeah, but I also think you can turn around and say, yes, obviously he's meant a lot for Liverpool and he's added a lot to the city and everything else, but he's also added a lot to the Premier League. I think where would he have been without Klopp? And, you know, yes, he's been been at Liverpool at a time where Manchester City and, you know, we were just discussing Guardiola, but without Klopp, where would the Premier League be? And, you know, I think he has pushed the envelope and added so much value to the product and to the whole feel about, you know, the excitement about the Premier League. So yeah, no, he's had a massive influence, not just on Liverpool, but on English football.
So I'm just wondering, in terms of, from an ex-player's perspective, guys, where does this leave Liverpool now? Because they know that the manager is going at the end of the season. Is this going to motivate them more? Are they going to go out even more and say, we're going to do it for Klopp, one final push? Or is it a bit of a downer that the manager's going? Like, how would you guys approach it if you were playing?
I think it's interesting because obviously the relationship, the rapport between Jurgen Klopp and his players is very, very strong. Oliver was talking about before about how he makes players better. There's very few players that haven't been successful under Jurgen Klopp. So I think the relationship with him is so close and so deep. We saw it with Virgil van Dijk when he gave his response to hearing the news about Klopp leaving. Like, all the players were completely in the dark about it, of course, and are quite, I think, shocked about the news, the decision. And I think a lot of players have signed for Liverpool and stayed at Liverpool because of Klopp. So it's an interesting one. I think if things don't quite go to plan in terms of results, maybe performances, sometimes you see it, players drop off. Sometimes you see people's heads drop. I'd like to think they won't. I'd like to think the way that Klopp has managed, the way he has his relationship with the players, I think they'll just keep going. And I know as a player, I'd be really bitterly disappointed if I was so much behind the manager and so much my decision to stay at a club, to sign for a club, was based on a manager. I'd be really disappointed and I'd feel a little bit let down in some degree, because you've made your long-term decision based on him being a manager. So I think it would be really tough to take at times throughout the season. And you would kind of almost try to put it to one side and go, right, let's deal with that at the end of the season. Let's try and make the most of what we have, the time we have together.
You know, I agree with you to some degree, Mark, but I feel like if I put myself in that dressing room, I think it's going to end up being really positive, because I think there's enough admiration and respect for Klopp. You know, the only time I've experienced it in my career was with the national team, where the long-serving manager decided to go after the World Cup, and it sort of also galvanized us, because we wanted to give him a good finish, because, you know, it's been such a big part of our career. And I think in football you're very short-sighted. I think, you know, you don't look at next season. I think these players are looking at finishing this project at the best possible way. You know, compared to other situations, we're going to talk about Barcelona, where there's already a negative atmosphere, and then it's going to go in the opposite direction. I think at Liverpool, things are right, and I think they're going to finish and potentially, again, keep challenging for trophies.
Oliver, is there any indication at all that there may be a negative effect on the Liverpool side between now and the end of the season?
No indication whatsoever. Obviously, they've only had one match at the moment, and that was against Norwich in the FA Cup yesterday, and you'd have expected them to win regardless, but they looked pretty, I mean, it was almost a B team, really, but they really dominated that match. It was very intense in terms of the way they played, and that didn't seem like a negative yesterday. But look, they've got some huge games coming up. I mean, Chelsea on Wednesday, Arsenal at the weekend. I mean, it's a week which will probably shape a narrative in terms of whether this team has been galvanized or slightly blown off course by the announcement. And I suspect probably neither at the moment, but I think people like me will probably be desperate to find some kind of conclusion or whatever from this. But I think as Thomas said, when there's a negative situation already, where the reason somebody's going is because it all looks quite frayed and it all looks like things are kind of unraveling and coming to the end of the line, I suspect the reality of it being the confirmation of that can actually make things worse over the coming, I would say Barcelona might end up sort of being in limbo rather than energized by it. But Liverpool, if they could, if it gets to the final sort of month, 2 months of the season, and Liverpool's still, maybe they'll have won the Carabao Cup by then, who knows? But if they're still competing on another three fronts, still in the title race, still in the FA Cup, still in the Carabao, in the Europa League, I think that will almost feel like this sort of huge emotional wave is powering them on. It could be really, really powerful. And Klopp has been very good at sort of harnessing that emotion and positive energy behind his team. So it'll be interesting to see which way it goes.
And finally, Oliver, I want to put you on a spot. So what are they going to win this season?
I will say Carabao Cup and Europa League. And come close to the Premier League.
Thomas, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think Europa League, I think it's the only one he hasn't won with Liverpool. And again, I think they'll beat Chelsea as well on the big day at Wembley. I don't think they'll overcome Man City, but, two trophies isn't bad of a finish.
Phil?
This is very difficult. They are 5 points clear at the top of the table. I mean, I know City have a game in hand, but they are 5 points clear, and maybe this will just push them. I didn't tip them to win the Premier League at the start of the season. It would be a little bit opportunistic to tip them now, but I've got a feeling that maybe they can do it. Maybe they can do it. So I'll say they'll win the Premier League, and then I don't know what they'll do with the other cups, but that's a big enough prediction from me, I think.
I'll probably cop a little stick from Chelsea fans, but I'm going to say I think they'll win the Carabao Cup as well. Chelsea are just too hit and miss. I think they'll win the Carabao Cup. I agree. Europa League, I think it's an interesting one, the Europa League, because it's a Thursday. It's a tough one. And obviously they're still in contention to win the league. If they weren't in the Europa League, I think there's a good chance they could go on and win the Premier League. I know Man City, that's weird to say that about Man City, because Man City are just relentless and can go on a 15-game running streak without losing. I'm going to be pretty much the same as you guys. I'm going to say Carabao Cup and win the Europa League and go very, very close to winning the league. So, yeah. Ollie, thank you very much for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure and great to hear your insight into Liverpool. Be very interested to see who takes over Liverpool come the end of the season.
It will. You're just wondering now about Liverpool by a Leverkusen final, maybe in the Europa League. Imagine that. It almost feels like that would send the football narrative gods crazy, I think. But
it's going to happen. It's going to happen, isn't it? It is going to happen now, just for this very reason. It's going to happen, absolutely. The WSL was in action again this weekend. Here's Narelle and Ash with everything you need to know.
Schwartzy, every week, Ash and I, we watch the WSL, hoping for a change, but nothing really ever does it, Ash? Chelsea always seem to win. That three-point buffer at the top is always there.
Yeah, it remains, doesn't it? And they just don't look like slipping up at the moment, do they? I mean, I tune in every Monday morning before we do the show and think, is this the week? No. But it seems like the league itself is in a bit of a holding pattern at the moment, doesn't it, Narelle? Like, those top three teams sort of keep winning. We've got some sort of tasty fixtures just around the corner in a couple of weeks where they sort of all play each other, and maybe that'll shake it up a little bit.
Yeah, something's got to give. But you mentioned that Chelsea, they don't really ever look like dropping points. And we thought they were okay without Sam Kerr. Lauren James has been great, but they've opened up their wallet and they've signed Colombian striker Myra Ramirez for what is a British record fee, and it could be a world record fee if the add-ons in her contract are made up. And I've actually worked it out. It's nearly $750,000 Australian dollars.
That's not bad.
Not bad at all, especially coming from Levante as well, where she's been doing great in Liga F, and it's just scary that she's untested in the league.
Yeah, it is scary. 24-year-old, But I tell you what, like that, they've already got so much quality across that squad, and signing her just adds to it. I mean, she, what is it, 4-year deal, mm-hmm. I think?
Yeah.
And it's just amazing. I love watching her at the World Cup. She's so smart with her runs off the ball, the way she uses her body, the way her touches, the way she brings other people into the game. Like, I cannot wait to see her play for Chelsea and sort of hit her stride, hopefully, for them. And, you know, if she can set up... I mean, Lauren James is creating stuff for herself out of sometimes nothing at the moment. If Ramirez is laying stuff off for her as well, it starts to become a sort of scary prospect.
And if you're a player or a fan of one of the other teams, reading that news, you're just thinking, oh my gosh, like, what do we have to do? But you always need a chaser. Sometimes you need two. And that's Manchester City and Arsenal. They're doing a great job at keeping the pressure on, keeping that gap to just 3 points. And Arsenal, though, is an interesting one in particular, because obviously we've got a lot of Aussies there. But something we've noticed recently is Steph Catley seems to have lost her spot in the starting 11.
That's the trouble when you go, you know, when you look at the Arsenal team, is like, I'm not sure I know what their best starting 11 is, and I don't think Jonas Eidevall does either. And unfortunately, Catley's dropped out at the moment of that starting lineup. I think she can fight her way back in because she's just such a quality player. But they're still, like, we're talking about how good Chelsea is, but we're still, we need to... They need to work out which Arsenal lineup is the best one, and I don't think they've worked it out yet. Man City looks settled, Chelsea looks settled. It'll be interesting to see how Arsenal go.
Absolutely. Schwartzy, do you guys see any of the chasers actually catching Chelsea from here?
Well, you know what? I don't think it's Chelsea. I mean, look, it is still Chelsea's to win or to lose, as one would say. They are ahead. They are 3 points ahead of Manchester City and Arsenal. I still think very much the three teams are in it. This could be the first WSL season whereby you can lose more than two games and still win the league for the first time ever. The 16th of February is when Chelsea play against Manchester City. That will determine whether or not Man City is still in the race, in my opinion. And then in March, they play Arsenal. So again, that will depend whether or not Arsenal is still in the race come that game in March. So I still think at this stage, there's three teams in it. So Man City and Arsenal still can catch Chelsea. Chelsea obviously have the huge loss of Sam Kerr, which we all know, and that's a tough one for them to deal with. And I think when you look at Man City, have just had the news just over the weekend that Jill Roord has done an ACL, another one unfortunately from the women's game that is out now injured. So that's a big blow to them. And of course, Chelsea, record transfer fee for a player in women's football in WSL, Ramirez Meira from Colombia, who was playing in Spain. So they're strengthened off the back of Sam Kerr being injured. Whether or not she performs straight from the off, that's a big if. But at the moment, they don't really need her because Lauren James is absolutely on fire, scoring another two goals on the weekend. So, I mean, at the moment, Chelsea don't need her, but there are bigger tests to come for Chelsea ahead. And of course, it always relies on those big individual clashes between City and Arsenal as well. So, and Chelsea do have the Champions League still to contest with, and something that Emma Hayes has never won, and something that she'd want to finish on a big bang of trying to win the Champions League. I think if Chelsea were given an option right now, if Emma Hayes were given an option, win the WSL title or win the Champions League, I think Emma Hayes would pick Champions League just this season, just because she's never won it before, maybe. Anyway, let's just wait and have to see what happens and how the next couple of weeks unfolds. Next up, we're going to chat La Liga and the Socceroos in the Asian Cup. But first, here's a taste of what's coming up on Optus Sport.
Breakfast football is back and it's midweek mayhem. 15 games across three mornings, Wednesday, Thursday and Friday. Some very tasty treats, including Forest Arsenal, Villa Newcastle, Tottenham Brentford, City Burnley, Liverpool Chelsea, Getafe Real Madrid, Wolves, Manchester United, and so much more.
Morata, finished in style.
Breakfast football on Optus Sport.
Let's get straight onto La Liga. And of course, the biggest news out of La Liga is Xavi to leave Barcelona at the end of the season. I suppose we're less surprised about it, aren't we? I think the most surprising thing is that he's still actually in his job until the end of the season, particularly after saying it's a cruel job. It wears you down. In Barcelona, you always feel like you're not valued. You're mistreated. That's how the club works. And at some point, you realize there's no point in staying. Phil, I mean, that's pretty full on. and pretty damning about Barcelona.
It is. He said a lot of things in this post-match announcement after they lost 5-3 at home to Villarreal. He said there can never be a Sir Alex Ferguson figure at Barcelona. That just won't happen here. He also spoke about the toll it's taken physically on him, on his mental health as well. It's clearly worn him down. And I fully understand his decision to step aside. What I don't necessarily understand is why he's going at the end of the season. He said, I feel that this is not sustainable. As a culé, as a Barcelona fan, I feel that the right thing to do now is to step down because the team needs a change. Okay, but you're still going to be there for another 5 or 6 months. So where's the change there? Usually when a manager steps down, someone new comes in, potentially a new manager bounce, new ideas, fresh coaching stuff. It's changed, and that can change the results on the pitch. And him staying for another 5 or 6 months, I just don't see how that is in necessarily the team's best interests. He's come out and said this, and I think he saved a little bit of face here because he felt like there was a pressure mounting. I spoke on the podcast before about him potentially going in the summer. I didn't think he was going to be sacked, but maybe the summer it was going to be difficult. And by coming out and doing this, it's projected to be on his terms. He said, I've decided I'm leaving, and it might have been a face-saving exercise. And also he said, you know, I feel liberated now. You know, this is going to be a bit of liberation now. You can't, speaking to the press, you can't kill me now. And if I'd stayed here for another year, you would have been on my back the whole time. So I guess he feels liberated, whether it's in the team's best interest. I really don't know. I really don't think we're going to see this kind of impact that we might see with Liverpool to do it for Jurgen. We might not see that, and they might just limp to the end of the season with another really disappointing campaign. So yeah, it's not necessarily a surprising decision, but the way it's been taken and the way it's going to play out is a little bit confusing.
Phil, take us into the head of, you know, you got Laporte and then you got Deco and the hierarchy at Barcelona. You know, what are they? What are they doing? You know, because again, you know, why would he say, you know, why would it be on his terms? Like, surely, you know, surely something has to come from them, or you would see some strong leadership, or is it just, you know, what's your view on it?
They had a talk after the game, Laporta and Xavi, for an hour. He took over an hour to come out for the press conference. And I'm sure in that hour, there were some pretty frank and sincere words that were exchanged. And my reading of the situation is that during that hour, Xavi took the initiative and he felt that he wanted to make this on his terms and say, right, I'm going to do this on my way. And if you want me to go, fine, but let me announce that I'm going in the summer. That's my reading of the situation. It's worth remembering that Xavi wasn't on Laporte's ticket in terms of the presidential elections. Xavi was aligned with a guy called Victor Font, and he was his choice for manager when he was trying to be the president of Barcelona, and it was Laporta who won. And Laporta had previously said Xavi wasn't going to be the manager, but then he sacked Ronald Koeman and brought Xavi in. So it wasn't like they had a close bond to begin with. You mentioned Deco, who is now the sporting director, who is very close to Laporta and also Jorge Mendes. But he wasn't the sporting director previously. That was a guy called Matteo Alemany, who left in the summer to go to Aston Villa, and then he wasn't leaving, and then he was coming back, and then he went to Aston Villa. It was all very, very strange. So behind the scenes, things have been an absolute catastrophe for Barcelona for a long time. And this just feels like a consequence of that. And it's, yeah, but I don't know if Xavi has too many allies at the moment. I read an interesting piece in The Athletic, friend and colleague Dermot Corrigan speaking about the lack of allies. So obviously Laporta, you know, Xavi wasn't really his man. Matteo Alemany, the sporting director, he got on well with him. He's gone. Jordi Cruyff, who was the international director, he got on well with him. He's gone. Sergio Busquets, who was, you know, his good friend and former teammate, he left as well, which had an emotional impact as well as a footballing impact as well. So I guess he might have felt a little bit alone there, Xavi, and has decided to call it a day.
And do you think, like, you know, you said he wanted to leave on his own terms. Do you think also that's an agreement they came to within the group, within the president and him talking? And almost, do you think almost the Laporta was almost I don't know, a little bit worried about sacking Xavi, considering his stature amongst Barcelona fans in terms of as a player?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, you know, he sacked Ronald Koeman. He was a pretty legendary figure for Barcelona, but he got sacked. But maybe if you're the president who loses Messi, sacks Koeman and sacks Xavi, I mean, it's, the optics on that aren't really great, aren't they? So, yeah, I mean, maybe Xavi deserved that to go out on his own terms, I guess. I mean, they won the league last season, guys. They won the league last season by double-digit difference. You know, this is...
So where did it all go wrong? So how's it all gone wrong in such a short period of time?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think if you go back and look at that league title, the margins were very, very fine. And I think we've mentioned this previously on the podcast, but last season they won matches 1-0 11 times. So they had 11 1-0 wins in that league victory. And a lot of those were down to Ter Stegen being extremely good in goal and Robert Lewandowski being extremely good in the penalty area. And this season, Ter Stegen's been injured in goal and Robert Lewandowski has looked a shadow of his former self. Coupled that with the fact that Sergio Busquets has gone and they didn't bring anyone really to replace him. They brought in Oriol Romeo for €3 million from Girona and surprise, surprise, he hasn't been able to replace one of the greatest defensive midfielders of all time. So yeah, it's difficult to pinpoint one thing. Maybe they did overachieve last season in winning the league title quite so comfortably. But this season it has really sort of fallen apart in terms of the title defence. And there have been injuries to Ter Stegen, to Gavi. Robert Lewandowski's form has fallen off a cliff. Jules Koundé has been really poor. Araujo's not been as good. So everybody seems to be underperforming, which may be an individual thing, or it may be down to the manager as well. So if he's lost the dressing room, then I guess he has to go. And if he can't keep getting the best out of these players, then I guess he has to go. But it is quite startling, given that, again, I repeat, they won the league last season by 10 points. It would have been more, but they won it with five games to go and they switched off for the last five games. They were really quite dominant last season. And this season, they've been nowhere near that.
I want to go back to the comment you made earlier on about what Xavi said, how he said that I'm going to leave at the end of the season so you can no longer kill me from the press perspective. He's not in the clear though, is he? Because if they don't have results, they'll be for his head to say, you need to walk now, right?
Yeah, potentially, but he might just feel, he said he feels liberated. So he might just feel like, okay, well, say whatever you like. I'm out of here in 5 months, whatever. I don't care that much. Barcelona job is ludicrously high pressure. We know that. I mean, Barcelona and Real Madrid, these jobs are insane high pressure. The local press and... It's not like being Manchester United or Liverpool, because these are huge clubs in the UK, but you do not have a 60-page daily newspaper, basically sports newspaper, basically dedicated to these clubs and the scrutiny. And they have to fill lots of pages and they go for you if they feel like they have to go for you. So the scrutiny is unreal. Xavi would have known that. Let's not forget that he was managing in the United Arab Emirates before he came here. This is his first big proper job in major European football. So he was on a learning curve as well. And he's learned that it is extraordinarily difficult to weather the storm that you always have to weather when you're Barcelona manager. That's why Carlo Ancelotti is so good at Real Madrid. It's not just what he does on the pitch. It's the way that he can deal with everything off the pitch as well, which is really, really difficult.
Yeah, but and also it seems like the situation now at Barcelona, it's on steroids compared to what it was in the past. You know, in the past, obviously you had Messi, you know, he would always give you something and you had, you know, at least the financials were in order. I think there just seems to be so much going on there that, yes, there's the footballing side and, you know, you can argue how well he's done there. He's obviously, you know, done reasonably well, but then everything else piled on top. With all the politics, all the financial woes that are there, well, yeah, you can feel why he's run down.
So I think we spoke about this maybe a couple of weeks ago when they lost the Super Cup to Real Madrid so convincingly, and it felt like these two clubs are in sort of diametrically opposed situations off the field. Like Real Madrid are really sort of healthy. Yeah, they've got debt, but it's a sustainable debt. They've just refurbished the stadium; it looks incredible. They've got money to spend on players within budget. And Barcelona are all over the place off the pitch. And you just imagine how difficult it is to be a manager, to be trying to work within those constraints. It is very, very difficult. And they've just been sort of teetering on the edge of everything. You know, we don't have money for this. Oh, we'll sell something else off. We don't have money for this. Let's sell something. It's always been just to the limit, on the edge. And that's no way to run a football club. And I don't think it's any surprise that we see Barca being pretty chaotic this season on the pitch, because they've been chaotic off the pitch for a long time. And they have spent money, because they sold off a huge chunk of their future TV rights. So they've spent a lot of money on Jules Koundé, spent a lot of money on Rafinha. Robert Lewandowski next season is going to earn 32 million euros, because his contract is structured in such a way that the third season is the one where he gets a big load of money. So I think with him not performing and the wages going up in the third season, they'll be looking to get Lewandowski out of the door. But yeah, it's just it's been run so terribly for such a long time, and it was run abysmally under Bartomeu. That's why they were in such financial straits. But Laporta's come in and he hasn't organised things. He's almost tried. He's, I don't know if he's made things worse, but he's certainly not made it any better indeed. And it's just a bit of a basket case off the pitch. And it's, like I said, it's no surprise to see them struggling on the pitch.
Where do you see the end for Barcelona? What happens to Barcelona moving forward? Does it continue to do what it's doing? Does it continuously be, what you say, chaotic, disorganised, sort of on the edge of destruction? Does it continue? Is there an end in sight?
It's difficult, Shorty, to know what the end game is with Barcelona. Now, something that's been touted, which is absolutely unthinkable to a lot of Barcelona fans and goes against their essence, but might be the future for them economically, is for them to become a sort of a limited company and not to be owned by their members. Because remember, Real Madrid and Barcelona, along with Athletic Club and Osasuna, the four teams in Spain that are owned by their members, they do not have external ownership. They are owned by their members, who vote and decide on a president who takes decisions. Barcelona are in such a bad financial state that it is being suggested now that Joan Laporta could consider making them into a company and getting external investment, because as things go at the moment, they can't continue like this. They can't. So, and I don't know if Joan Laporta is the kind of guy to take them forward with prudence and care that is needed in this very difficult situation. So I don't know what the end game is, but that is potentially one for Barcelona, which would upset a lot of Barcelona fans. But Laporta would possibly argue it would keep them afloat and make them financially very successful. Who knows?
Okay, so a club like Barcelona in such disarray on and off the pitch, where do they turn to next now that Xavi's leaving? And not only that, who would even want the job? I know it's Barcelona, right? But all that chaos, all that off-field uncertainty, money, like you're juggling like a circus act to try and find money to buy and sell players. Who would want the job, Phil? And who would they want?
Yeah, it's a good question, because it's not the draw that it might have been, you know, a few years ago. But it is still Barcelona. It is still a massive job. You are still taking charge of one of the biggest clubs in the world in one of Europe's most beautiful city. So I think you can sell it to some managers, but can you sell it to the highest level of elite manager in the continent? And there I might have my doubts. So as soon as this, you know, this news came out, a few people were, you know, putting two and two together and coming up with Jurgen Klopp to Barcelona. That is probably not going to happen. Although we were speaking earlier with Oliver about, you know, was Jurgen Klopp, and he is a sort of a Liverpool fit, a Borussia Dortmund fit, not a Real Madrid fit. He'd be more a Barcelona fit than Real Madrid. But yeah, his wage demands might be a little bit beyond what Barcelona can offer him. I think in terms of if they're looking for someone, I think they can still sell it to someone in Spain. So a Spanish manager coming up from a lower level Spanish team that is doing really well would still see the Barcelona job as being massive and a huge step, and maybe even the peak of their career. So someone like Michel, who is the current manager of Girona, who is doing such extraordinary things with Girona, we'll get on with him in just a second. He certainly looked as a possible replacement. There is Francisco García Pimienta, who is the manager of Las Palmas, who is doing really well with Las Palmas and was in the Barcelona Youth Academy for 20 years. He was manager of Barcelona B. He's got a clear style. He knows the identity. He knows what the club is all about. But he also knows what Joan Laporta is all about. And he does not have a very good relationship with the president. So that is potentially a no-go. And then there's Emmanuel Aguafil, who is the manager of Real Sociedad. He's done unbelievable work with them. But he kind of feels like a one club man, so I'm not sure if he'd take the move. So if you're asking me who are the runners and riders, I think they will look within Spain, because I'm not sure they can bring someone or sell it to someone huge overseas, get someone in like Klopp, Xabi Alonso, if he wasn't a Real Madrid man, someone like that. I'm not sure they could sell it to them.
Thomas, yeah, any ideas?
I agree. And I think it's important that the league, the language, with everything that's going on there. I think, especially when you can't get someone with a big personality, with the credentials, all the trophies, who holds the respect. I think it's hard to get, an up and coming international aspiring manager to go into Barcelona. I think that will be very tough. So I agree that Michel, I think, is a good choice. I think they can probably get him fairly cheap, from Girona. And, so I think that's also going to play a big part in it. It's not someone that they have to buy for millions and millions. And, I quite agree with Phil on this one.
I think you missed one. I think both of you have missed one. Yesterday, the rumours coming out of London, England, Mikel Arteta has been potentially... he's been mentioned about possibly also leaving Arsenal into the season. Whether that's true or not, let's wait and see. But that could work, couldn't it, Phil, with Barcelona?
Former Barcelona B player, never made it to the full team, but he came through the youth academy. He's got an idea of how the club works. I can't see that one happening, have to say. I read the article that we were sharing on our WhatsApp group yesterday, and the article was a little bit tenuous, I have to say, and it certainly feels a little bit convenient that this story comes out in this very pro-Barca Catalan newspaper 24 hours after Xavi decides he's leaving. So I wouldn't read too much into it, but it is certainly a story that has been making headlines here in Spain and in the UK as well. But Mikel Arteta to Barca, I think, is possibly a little bit of a stretch.
Right, we've talked enough about Barcelona because there are more teams than La Liga, right? And of course, the one near the top, Girona, keeps going, don't they?
They keep going. They're top of the table after 22 match days. They're a point clear of Real Madrid. They went to Celta Vigo and they beat them 1-0 and heaped more pressure on Rafa Benitez, who's manager of Celta Vigo, and just 1 point above the relegation zone. But Girona are 1 point clear of Real Madrid, who went to Las Palmas without Jude Bellingham and still managed to get a victory. They had to work quite hard for it. It wasn't a brilliant performance from Real Madrid, but they managed to get the victory in the end with a late goal from Aurelien Tchouaméni. Vinny Jr. scored first after Las Palmas had taken the lead. So, yeah, the two teams who are battling for the title at the moment, which is Girona and Real Madrid, both won games, the kind of game that you have to win if you're going to win the league title. So it was a weekend where those two at the top kept going, did what they had to do. And there's a point between them. Interesting, we've got a few midweek fixtures coming up because the teams that took part in the Spanish Super Cup a couple of weeks ago had their league fixtures postponed. So this midweek, we've got Barcelona against Osasuna and Atletico Madrid against Rayo Vallecano, and then Getafe against Real Madrid. So those are the games that Barcelona, Atletico and Real Madrid have in hand against Girona. So after this weekend, they're all going to have the same, or after this midweek, they're all going to have the same number of fixtures played, and we'll see where we're at. If Real Madrid win that, they'll go 2 points clear of Girona with the same number of games played. And yeah, there will be a slight twist to that title race because Real Madrid will be back on top with the same number of games played. So, guys, we should leave La Liga and the Premier League and all that stuff and focus on what we really need to talk about, and that is the Asian Cup and the Socceroos through to the quarterfinals. And they beat Indonesia 4-0. Obviously, Thomas lives in Australia, works in Australia. Mark, you're Australian, aren't you, Schwartzy? You are. Yeah, so good. Two good guys to talk about this with. Now, tell me, they won 4-0 Australia, right? Can you ever win 4-0 and it be a disappointing performance, because this is the kind of vibe that I'm getting from what I'm reading, what I'm hearing, that Australia won 4-0, but didn't actually play particularly convincingly.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? So you're playing against a nation that's ranked, what, 128 in the world or 140 something in the world, Indonesia, and you're, and Australia, what, 25, I think we are in the world right now. You're expected to brush those opponents aside. And there is merit in that. And did we play well? No, we didn't play well, but we did what we needed to do. I thought the energy was there, the intensity was there for a lot of periods of the game. They
the spark,
did what they had to do.
The spark in the final third?
Was better than against Uzbekistan, where they let it slip. 1-0 up against Uzbekistan. I thought they played reasonably well, and then almost took their foot off the pedal a little bit. And then as the game went on, they missed a couple of big chances, and then kind of were obviously made to pay in the end. Uzbek scoring the equaliser. Against Indonesia was different. They were a little bit more prolific in front of goal. The chances they were pretty decent finishes with their goals. And I thought that it was job done. No, could they play better? Absolutely. But it's a 4-0 win in the round of 16 game, gets them through to the quarterfinals. And now this is where the big test begins, because they're either going to play Saudi Arabia or South Korea, who I would say South Korea have massively underperformed. Jürgen Klinsmann's under enormous amount of pressure because of his consistently smiling on the sidelines. Even when they drew against Malaysia 3-3 and they conceded in the last minute, he was smiling. And apparently the South Koreans are not happy with him at all. So apparently the social media is going absolutely bananas about Jürgen Klinsmann and the players. So look, it's an interesting one. I think they're getting slightly better. I think the performance was slightly better. And it's about, you know, getting to the final or as far in the tournament as possible, not peaking too soon. And they certainly haven't peaked too soon, that's for sure. And there's a lot of improvement ahead for the Socceroos. But look, I'm one of those ones who think job done. I know how hard it is to play against teams who are so much lowerly ranked than you are, and you're expected to beat them, and you're expected to beat them convincingly, and you're also expected to play incredibly well against them. That is not easy. So I'm reasonably happy with the result, and I know the performance can get better.
Yeah, and I think we also have to look at the further Australia go in this tournament, the more the role will suit them. You know, the more of an underdog they potentially will be, and it'll suit their playing style as well. Because we have to be honest that, you know, there's not a lot of huge individual talent. You know, there's sparks. We saw Craig Goodwin, he came on, and I thought he made a difference. You know, there's some young players, Jordy Boss, that can spark, you know, from time to time. You know, Miss Duke, I think they need him fully fit. And Fonaroli, you know, he's been great in the A-League, but, you know, he still hasn't scored for the Socceroos. So I think, but sitting back against, you know, either Saudi Arabia or South Korea, where you will maybe be the underdog or at least at the same level, I think it was actually suit them, because they you know, they're keeping clean sheets. You know, Matty Ryan didn't have much to do in this game. You know, they're strong on set plays. And sometimes you have to play to your strengths. And you know, let's be honest, we can't expect them to be, you know, Brazil or Argentina or France. You know, they are who they are. And I think they can still win this tournament if he mixes the cards right and with a little bit of luck as well. And as the games come up, they'll suit them better.
You were going to say Barcelona then, weren't you? That can't be as good as Barcelona.
I was, but yeah. But,
yeah,
but,
because
yeah,
you know, I don't want that. I don't want that comparison right now, because I don't think
no,
Barcelona
I'm talking
can.
About 10 years ago Barcelona.
Okay, that's
fine. What I'm talking about.
Yeah, that's
who
fine.
Who would win now? Australia versus Barcelona?
I'd love to see that game. Hey, that's
Let's a tight contest. That's another whole podcast all in itself. Let's not even go there. I think there's this one really in particularly fascinating stat for me. Harry Suter has now scored as many goals for the Socceroos as Mark Viduka. That is mind-blowing. I mean, I've just looked up Mark Viduka's stats with the national team. 43 appearances, 11 goals. And it just seems like that has to be wrong. I feel like that just can't be right.
Yeah. Well, you were there.
But that's the strength, though. That's the strength, you know, of the team. I think, you know, you got Jackson Irvine as well. So you can, like, with that
No, the stat about Mart Viduka.
Win any game.
No, I mean the stat about Mart Viduka only scoring 11 goals.
Yeah, of
has
course.
To be
but I'm saying in the current, of course, you know, but he's a defender. But, you know, I think it's a huge strength for the current team that, you know, that you have, you know, those kind of players that in a tight game can score. And Suter has been brilliant over the last couple of years since he's come in.
That, I mean, that goal was undefendable, right? That delivery from the free kick was absolutely superb, and the run and obviously the flick on you can't defend against that.
No. So you know, and that's a weapon, and so that's why I think in these tight games, you know, that's an advantage you have to use.
Saudi or South Korea in the next round? What's your gut feeling about it, Thomas?
You know what? I think I would prefer Saudi. I think, you know, they haven't been too impressive. I think Mancini's been at the head there. There'll be a lot of pressure on him. You know, I don't like any team with Son in. I think he can always do something on his own. You know, despite them not playing potentially to what we expected, I still would want Saudi Arabia, I think, and I think Socceroos could beat them.
I'm absolutely desperate for Saudi Arabia to beat South Korea so Son can get back to North London.
Well, look, I think there's a possibility, right? Because South Korea just have not been performing well. And like I said earlier on in my intro, Jürgen Klinsmann, I mean, I've even read a report from a South Korean, maybe it's less South Korean journalist, maybe it was Lost in Translation, sorry. And it was him saying that the South Korean football fans hate him. So
for smiling.
That's one of the things. They think the team's got no direction. They've got no understanding of how they want to play. And that Klinsmann is not leading by authority on the sideline. He's just basically standing there with a grin on his face for vast majority of time. The assistant is the one barking orders on the sideline. That probably has to do with language, of course. So there is a lot of unhappy people. And also, since
I thought the Catalan press was harsh.
Well, yeah. And then since the World Cup, obviously South Korea did well at the World Cup. There were some players there that were really lauded for their performances. And now they've been absolutely attacked by people on social media. And it's really affecting the team. So there are a lot of things that are not right in the South Korean side right now. So I think, I agree. I think if Saudi Arabia can knock them out, that is a big plus. And chances for the Socceroos. Obviously, they have to get past Saudi Arabia. But in terms of getting one of the big, big teams, for me, pre-tournament, one of the favourites in South Korea out of the tournament. Right, that's all we've got time for this week, guys. Thanks, Phil. Thank you, Thomas, for joining us as always. It'll be very interesting to hear your insights, certainly, Phil, from a Barcelona perspective and of course, us trying to digest all the news with Xavi and Jurgen Klopp leaving at the end of the season. Remember, you can watch every game of the Premier League, La Liga and the WSL live and exclusive on Optus Sport. See you next time.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.